Agents of Smooch. We are traveling today to Hong Kong for a quick virtual vacation, but maybe we'll stay for a year or two or so. We're going to be discussing the 2015 movie Already Tomorrow in Hong Kong. I am Smooch director Annette Weirstra, and for this leg of our continuing virtual vacation, I have two of our agents joining me. Hello, Agent Moises Chulian. How are you?
Hello. I desperately want Cantonese spicy crab. Unfortunately, there's none to be gotten at the moment.
Oh, I just always want dim sum. That's my go-to. And I also have Agent Quinn Rose with me. Hello.
Hello. For the first time, I thought about the logistics of this virtual vacation, and I kind of like how you are hypothetically flying across the world, and we, the other co-hosts, are just materializing wherever you arrive.
We have, like, TARDISes or, what do you call them in Star Trek?
Spaceships?
No, they beam people down. That's it.
Oh, yeah.
We
get transporters.
Like, no, not spaceships. Like, let's delete all the travel part if we have to be virtual and no airplanes required.
It's true. There you go.
Already Tomorrow in Hong Kong. I had not heard of this movie before we started planning this, and we're looking for movies in different fun locations. And I believe it was Moises, you suggested it.
Yes, it's one that came up for me. I get loads and loads of press release emails about all kinds of indie movies. And I like Brian Greenberg and Jamie Chung. I know various parts of both of their filmographies. I think they're very interesting performers. And anytime there is a romantic movie that involves a real life couple that is not a super bazillion dollar budget action movie, that is something that that interests me. And especially something dealing with culture clash and that sort of thing, and going to the present day of my ancestral home of Hong Kong. I love seeing things that are familiar from seeing it in movies, even though I've never been there myself. And I responded to one of the emails at some point or another and watched a screener of it and wrote a review for some place that who knows if they actually posted it. And I just I really enjoy the movie. It gets everything done in under 80 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate a movie that feels like it doesn't need to be 100 minutes long just for the sake of being 100 minutes long, and managing to tell a whole lot of story and do a lot of really beautiful, nuanced character stuff with whatever runtime it takes.
I would just want to echo some of what you just said, especially with the runtime and being like a very simple but well done movie. And I'm not going to spoil the ending, but a lot of what I have to say about this movie is about the ending, because I watched the whole thing and was like, oh, this is like a nice thing and I see where it's going, la-di-da. And then the way that it ended, I was like, suddenly the choices that they made in the last scene like ratchet this movie up, where now I haven't been able to stop thinking about it since I watched it, because it totally reverses what you're expecting.
Yeah, it feels like it is backing into something that is almost a series of common tropes for indie romances. And the way the movie ends pays things off in such a beautiful way for me, touching back on, you know, some of my favorite French films that leave things in a place that are not so neat and not so tied up, and give you an opening to think about things. And when thinking about this movie, I mean, the first thing that came to mind, honestly, was Before Sunrise and that whole series that is predominantly focused around two people. And this very much feels like a next generation take on that kind of narrative. And there are things that you feel like you know for sure, and there are things that it leaves open that I don't want to spoil. And I just, I love it. I love the boldness of the choices the whole way through. Because once you get to that ending, it pays off all of the 74 minutes before in ways that I did not expect when I first sat down watching it. And it was, oh, this is cute. Okay, this is nice. Oh, they're wandering around and they're getting to know each other. But it's that ending that really makes the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you haven't watched the movie, pause. We'll wait. Go watch it. Because we're going to talk about the ending. We'll wait till the end of the podcast. But we are going to talk about the ending. I feel like this is like intriguing, hopefully. Like you said, Quinn, I keep thinking about this movie. And I think it is in part because of how they put it together. And I watched it for the first time when we were planning this. And then again this weekend. And it's just like, it really stuck with me in a way I didn't expect it to. I also didn't know they were together in real life, which I love. until today. So I went and looked at their wedding pictures, which I'll put a link in the show notes. But they're like so cute in real life. I like that.
Yeah, it's like no wonder that they have good chemistry.
Yeah.
They literally have good chemistry.
So should we start with the first meeting? So the premise of the movie is that you have two people who just happen to meet, and Josh, who is living in Hong Kong, takes Ruby, who is just there for a quick visit, trying to find some friends, doesn't know her way, and he just offers like, oh, it's kind of confusing, I'll just walk you to where you need to meet your friends. And they have a conversation, and that is the entirety of their first meeting. And it's such a simple premise, but they have this is a very conversation heavy, action light movie, so you have to be in the mood for that kind of thing. I think
one of the things I like about the kickoff to this is that it's a situation that I find myself in, where as a guy who will note that someone looks lost or is looking for directions or needs help in some way, I can be hesitant to how I approach said person, because there are a lot of really terrible, creepy guys mm-hmm. that are precisely the reason that she initially reacts the way that she does. And so trying to be helpful, there's another layer on top of wanting to be helpful that includes making sure that you are making it known to the person you are trying to offer some Good Samaritan assistance to, that you are indeed trying to help in a not creepy way that is not going to involve stalking them or following them or anything. And the awkwardness of that read so realistically that I'm sure that both of them have been through different sides of that experience multiple times, and that influenced the script by the director. But it's played so well, beyond being scripted really well.
I've totally done both of those things, accepted help and offered the help. But I think as a woman, you don't have to second guess the offering the help as much for, you know, reasons. Obviously, but I have been, you know, I want to trust people and I want to just accept people at face value, but you do get like following some dude off into a strange city is a little bit nerve-wracking. So yeah, I did like that tension there.
Yeah, and it's sweet the way that they meet as well, and they start to interact, and like they obviously have a connection very quickly, and then it is acknowledged in different ways as the story kind of goes on. There is like that, I think, a very realistic tension, as we're talking about, between like, well, you're a stranger and this is a strange city, but you know, you seem okay and things are going pretty well between us. And then he keeps going with her to like next locations mm-hmm. to where she's trying to get to. And then eventually they fork off and just get a drink by themselves because everything is so busy. And I also think that like her being so unfamiliar with the city and everything makes this a more realistic scenario, because I mean, if like I was in a city where I was very sort of overwhelmed and unfamiliar with everything, and then I met someone who also was from the US, I'd be like, oh my God, help me. Like, great. Mm-hmm. Like, and so it sets them up really well to sort of have this evening together.
And it really, like, it reads very clearly from the beginning. He's just trying to be helpful, and he's kind of over it being at that bar for this birthday party where he's being treated like a piece of furniture, is the way that he's made to feel. So he's like, well, I can do something nice for this person who needs some help, and that'll kill some time, because oh my God, kill me, I hate this, I'm having a miserable time. His interest in her is not there from the outset. There is not that kind of, you know, I'm looking to cheat on my girlfriend kind of a thing going on. It is just literal nice guy, the rarest thing on the planet these days. And seeing the way that he kind of goes, oh, she seems kind of nice, huh? Well, this is an interesting person, and things grow organically. And it's not either one of them playing with some of the stuff that we get to later in the movie, where they're feeling like their interest in feelings for each other, their lingua franca that they kind of settle into with very little effort, which neither one of them is used to, is something that we get to see very, very early in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it feels so realistic. It's a little bit awkward, and it's a little bit smooth, and a little bit awkward, and a little bit smooth, and it's never too much of one of the other thing.
Well, I've made vacation friends, you know, where you're in that situation where, and it is about finding someone where you have some sort of commonality, whether it's like your interest or your age or your country or something, and you like spend some time hanging out. I did a solo tour through Europe when I was younger, and I just meet up with people and hang out with them, and it can be totally platonic. And I do like that that's how it started, and clearly because it makes him more likable, because what you find out later towards the end of this first meeting is he left the bar of his girlfriend's birthday. So I just think he intended to be gone for 5 to 10 minutes and then come back and pick up things. And then this stranger intrigued him and pulled him along. And it was never a conscious decision. It just sort of happened.
Although, I mean, I don't think that like he did set out with this plan to like seduce a stranger or anything yeah. like that. I really believe that it was quite genuine for a while. I do think that like once he gets to the point where he does invite her to just have a drink and kind of escape the crowds, he is definitely getting to the point where he is attracted to her and he knows he's attracted to her, and he still doesn't tell her that he has a girlfriend. She's beginning to be like, oh, like this is going well with this guy who she thinks is available. And so when she does find out that he has a girlfriend before anything happens between them, but like I think very clearly, obviously, after an emotional connection and a flirtation is developed, she's obviously furious with him for misleading her, which I totally understand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And kudos on her for calling him out on it, because it would be easy to just be like, oh, and pretend like that connection never happened and just breeze past it, pretend it didn't happen, pretend you didn't have those feelings and move on. But I like that she called him out on it.
And the thing is, I feel like the inflection point that he is at in that relationship, that he is at that bar for that birthday party,
mm-hmm.
is that he's thinking maybe this is not for him if his girlfriend is going to constantly be flirting with other guys and playing games in the literal sense of emotionally manipulative stuff to get a rise out of him. And we never see her side of this. So maybe he is a monster. maybe he's not a good guy. But it seems like, at least from his perspective, from his point of view, he may be at the point where he is looking to wind that relationship down, because he's realizing that as much as it has worked, this is somebody that he is with, has been with for a long enough amount of time, but that it does not feel like it has the kind of ease that he wants it to. Just because you're in a relationship does not mean that the relationship should continue by default. If it is not working and it is not an equal sort of a playing field, you know, you should not feel guilty for wanting to get out of it. But it's a matter of how you get out of it. And, you know, the reason she dresses him down is very valid, because it directly comes off like he is, you know, this sleazy dude who will just pal around with some attractive new girl that he meets while he is at his own girlfriend's birthday party. So, yeah, it's messy and complicated, just like real life. And I think that's what hooked me initially and kept me along for the ride for the rest of the movie.
So going, like, leaping forward, they meet for a second time, coincidentally, on a ferry 1 year later. We find out that she's been living in Hong Kong and for her job. So in the meantime, she's moved to Hong Kong for a year. And we find, like, for me, when they start catching up, the thing I was surprised about was that he was still with his girlfriend, because I felt the same thing as you, Moises, that it was like, oh, it's not really, you know, but at 1 year later, he's still with his girlfriend.
Yeah. And also an important note is that when they met the first time, he was working in finance,
mm-hmm.
which I got a good laugh out of. I have a lot of friends who work in finance. But and she basically encourages him to quit his job and to become a writer, which is his passion. And he does. And so when they meet the second time, like, he quit his job however many months ago and is a writer now. And I think that that is such a meaningful thing in this movie, to point out that, like, that first meeting that they had such a profound effect on him.
Yeah, and he did that without knowing that he would ever see her again. So it had nothing to do with her and everything to do with her sort of inspiring him.
Yeah.
It's just interesting when you see them meet the second time, that dynamic between them, he has to win back her trust because she does not trust him. And there's that clear, it's not like they fall into a good rhythm again, and he has to sort of win her back, and he's actively trying to. But at the same time, both of them are honest at this point that they're unavailable. They are both seeing other people. It's this interesting walk that's much different in feel, I find, than the first meeting.
When we have that lovely, you know, romance staple of she's engaged, she's getting married to the wrong man. We get her at this place in her life where she I feel like we learn, at least the way that I perceived it, we learn that she definitely has some version of cold feet about this, that it does not feel sweeping and romantic and great. It's like her relationship with Greg, aka Daniel, is fine. It's not great. It's not stupendous. It's not sweeping. It's fine. It's totally fine. And when she runs back into him and he is dressed in not finance guy clothes and says, oh yeah, I don't work for HSBC anymore. The way that I read her reaction was like, oh damn, a girl has powers. Okay. All right. Huh. And I think it, her seeing her expectations subverted, and as she starts working out that he's still in that relationship and she can tell that he's unhappy in that relationship, and that meeting her for one night made him make a change, a fundamental change in his life, and watching her process that over the second half of the movie, it's wonderful. And seeing the two of them building trust as they are both getting more honest with where they are in their lives. And they want to keep hanging out with each other, even though they know that there are those impediments. And one of the things that I don't feel is always handled as well as it is, that this movie does a beautiful job of, is when Ruby brings up emotional cheating. They do anything. They dance together. But the way that they got lost in each other's eyes, that's a thing. Like, that is a whole thing that your heart and your head are doing. You know, that was another thing that surprised me as the movie went on, is it got so much more about that kind of body language energy between people without having to layer a bunch of cheesy lines or use a bunch of crane shots or anything. Like, the movie is perfectly happy to just shoot them moving around through the sea of people in whatever street that they're in, whatever street corner they're on, wherever it is they're going, just letting this happen against this beautiful backdrop that this movie definitely did not have the money to, you know, close down streets and do that kind of thing. In Hong Kong, if you're going to shoot a movie, you're kind of shooting it around whatever's happening. That really lent a lot of authenticity to the kind of these people finding their way to truths about themselves, truths about each other as they're going along.
I will say that in my experience in watching this movie, because it is such a kind of visceral depiction of a relationship and very real interactions between that relationship and the way that it deals with it, I was pretty strongly against Josh for a lot of the movie because mm-hmm. because of his first scene. Like, or the way that he didn't tell Ruby that he had a girlfriend until way too mm-hmm. late in the game. And then as the movie continued and they're seeing these moments where, like, Josh is indicating that his relationship isn't quite right for him, and like the crab and everything, on one level, like, okay, sure, if we take him at his word, these are like genuine experiences that he's had and like signs that maybe this relationship isn't right and he's only staying in it for, you know, sunk cost fallacy. But there are also like many experiences where people will say things like that and indicate that their relationship isn't quite working and isn't right, and that the person that they're with, like, doesn't appreciate them right or, like, doesn't treat them right, as a manipulation tactic to get with someone. So that, like, mm-hmm. that really kind of set my teeth on edge for a lot of the movie, because it was hard for me to gauge how genuine he actually was and how genuine, like, the movie wanted us to think he was, because those might not be the same thing. At this point, like, reflecting on it and like seeing the whole movie, I do think that he was being honest. He wasn't just trying to manipulate her. Even after all this time, still a little mad at him for not telling the truth from the onset.
I totally agree with you. Like, that's one of the tropes in romance that I hate, is the deceit that was necessary. I never feel like it's quite necessary. And it feels like a cheap way to gin up conflict. And it's the reason that for most of the movie, like, I had a similar thing where I was like, okay, he's saying all this, but how legit is it? Because we're not, like I mentioned earlier, we're not seeing his girlfriend's side of this, or even ever seeing his girlfriend. So it feels like the exact kind of gaslighting situation that you were describing, Quinn, where it's like, I don't know if I trust this guy with a half beard. And it really takes the majority of the movie's runtime to be kind of okay with Josh. And I still have that lingering thing of, that's a big screw up to have. But again, like, because of the way that the movie resolves and it doesn't go for the necessary, like, the very tidy love conquers all, everything's perfect and nice and everything ending, it isn't to say that this is necessarily a perfect thing for both of them, or even necessarily a good thing for both of them. But yeah, I come out the other side of the movie where I'm kind of okay with them potentially getting together. But at the same time, there's that, what other kinds of information would he withhold if he would withhold something that simple on the day that you meet somebody?
And I think the movie never really answers that question either, where we don't know what the truth is. We only know his version of the truth and her version of the truth. And she does say to her relationship with Daniel is a on again, off again relationship. And it was off again when they met. But I think they'd been together for like 5 or 6 years or something, which always I find that is a never great dynamic. If you're on again, off again. But yeah, and do we believe him? I think that moment when, I love the moment when he's trying to get her to go to the bar to listen to the band, and they both know exactly it is not just going to a bar to listen to a band, and it's not completely platonic anymore. Like, by taking that next step, you can no longer just say, we've just run into each other, nothing's happening, we had, like, we stopped, hung out, and moved on. By moving to that next location, sort of is investing more into this, whatever the relationship is, and exploring it, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. But clearly the Monica, his girlfriend's friend, that sees them dancing together, because you can dance with a guy and it can be completely platonic. This was not, they were not having a platonic moment in that, and that comes around to the emotional cheating again. So it just is so interesting to me. And I think that's why I keep thinking about the movie, is because you're trying to dissect, how do you feel about what's going on between them? And it's not clear cut.
The other element to kind of all of their dynamic throughout the movie that's very interesting is them talking about kind of cultural differences. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way the movie sets it up is not something that you see depicted in film very often, that you have, they're both from the United States and they have a bit of like East Coast, West Coast banter, which I appreciated. But Josh has been living in Hong Kong for 10 years, and Ruby is just visiting slash has only lived there for less than a year. But also, like, Ruby's family is Chinese and Josh is a white man. And so they have, like, different conversations about, like, their different experiences and, like, immigration versus being an expat and, like, sort of your family's culture versus, like, where you live's culture and all these different things that I thought was done in a very thoughtful way.
Yeah, there was a danger zone of, is Josh one of those yellow fever dudes? One of those guys who likes living in Hong Kong because, you know, like the guys who go to live in Japan because they were chairman of the anime club in high school. Oh boy, I really hope this isn't one of those. But knowing that the two of them were together going into this, I gathered that was probably not the direction it was going to go. But I thought it was incredibly, incredibly true to life that she did address the kind of thing of, you know, who you date, what kind of people that people date, and turn it around on her. And there was that whole conversation. That's a pretty good litmus test in a lot of cases. There are a lot of things that Asian women in particular are very used to hearing that just send off every single alarm bell. The intersection of a fully assimilated, you know, she's second generation after her grandparents, I think she said, immigrated to the States. She's fully assimilated, doesn't speak any Chinese, you know, fully does not understand how you negotiate and haggle in Hong Kong, which is just how you get things. I mean, that, you know, everywhere, whether you're buying a suit or food, it's all over the place. And things that he's been there for 10 years, not he read a guidebook and he's been there for a year and a half. Just dealing with what he is, whether he's an expat or an immigrant, that just had me living because it's something you just don't get mm-hmm. in movies a lot of times. It's something you get, you know, doom scrolling on your Twitter feed, but is the kind of thing that movies try to shy away from. And that's one of the things that kept me engaged in the conversation, even though I had those kinds of misgivings of, is this a well-intentioned but accidentally problematic kind of a thing? White guy, Asian girl. Oh, no. But that they got into all those nuances really, really, it meant a lot, and it engaged me really directly because they were talking about stuff that you just don't get much of in a lot of movies in general, let alone romance.
I did my master's in intercultural communication, so that whole aspect really interested me because you don't often hear about it. And, you know, this was... Because a lot of times you'll have sort of the ugly Westerner going into another culture and just sort of just going in so awkwardly and not really thoughtfully about experiencing a place. And so having them have those kinds of conversations and I think having that perspective of someone who'd been there for a long time and fallen in love with the space, I really enjoyed those conversations because there's no clear-cut answers for a lot of questions around that. It's of kind of how you have the discussions, and I loved it.
Oh yeah. And the other kind of trope that I was afraid they were gonna fall into for a little bit was this man like teaches her how to respect her mm-hmm. own culture mm-hmm. kind of angle that like it seemed like they might kind of be doing, and I was like, oh no, don't do that.
Watch, beautiful lady, I will teach you kung fu.
I was like, no. But I think that they didn't do that path either. And they allowed like both of them to make like end points when they had sort of conflict about their different perspectives. I feel like they both made good points about it and like both pointed out really interesting things about it rather than it being a position where like one is teaching the other explicitly. Yep. So I was like, mm-hmm. okay. Thank you.
They skirted that one for sure. So shall we go to the ending and discuss why this ending has impacted all of us?
I would love to throw it to Quinn because of that emphatic noise she just made.
Let's start with you, Quinn.
Okay. So let me just set the scene. Hopefully if you've listened to this part, you have watched the end of the movie, watched the movie. But I'm sitting here, I'm watching this movie. This was a couple weeks ago, and I think I was looking down because I was like taking notes or something or whatever I was doing. And then the movie stops mm-hmm. and I look up and I was like, what? Was that the end of the movie? Because they get in a car, they get in a cab, and they are going to split the cab and go to their respective homes. Ruby is sort of emotionally exhausted and kind of mad because she says that they've been emotionally cheating and she hates that they've done that. And so they're at this very tense point, and then they acknowledge to each other that they do have feelings for each other, but they also aren't ready to leave their other relationships and they don't want to like uproot their whole lives. She's actually engaged to this other man, and what are they going to do? And at this point, you know, as the viewer watching a rom-com, you're expecting them to fall into each other's arms and to accept the fate of true love, and they ride off happily ever after. Mm-hmm. But they don't. They are like, what are we going to do? And they look at each other, and the movie ends.
It goes black.
And the cabbie's like, do you still want another stop? And that's the last sentence spoken in the movie.
So either he gets out with her at her apartment and they presumably leave their partners and are together, or he doesn't and they never see each other again. And there is no canonical answer to what they do.
I have a third headcanon thought of what Ooh. Happened, which is that they somehow come to an accord of, we need to deal with this in a way that we both feel good about, because that's so much of what everything that preceded it felt like it was going toward for me. Like, I feel like it's too easy for them to, you know, fall madly into each other's arms in her apartment. And I don't think either one of them would feel good about that. But what would make sense to me is we both have stuff that we need to address before we can literally be in the same space together. Do we want to do that or not? Do we want to send part of our lives off of a cliff? Because thinking about the connection the two of them had, my feeling was that they wouldn't get out of the cab together. Or if they, look, you know, life is messy, life is complicated. Maybe they did, but it felt like they would find a path that wasn't the, okay, let's be miserable forever with people that we obviously at this point are not thrilled with. You know, she has a fiance who proposed over a phone call and said we would pick out a ring when we see each other next. So romantic, so dashing. And he's with someone who he's been with for a couple of years now, and he's given literally all the indications. It's very much the sunk cost fallacy. I feel like there is a version of they get together, but not that they wildly fall into each other's arms passionately after both of them distinctly not feeling good about getting caught emotionally cheating and wanting to figure out a decent, respectful way to take care of their own business before they continue whatever this is. And even if both of them think maybe this won't turn into something, I feel like they would, having learned everything they've learned through the course of the movie, want to take that step first. It seems like the two of them have a conscience. Like, I say all that, and I tie myself in knots thinking about that for 6 hours, and then I go, no, they totally go up to that apartment,
banged.
And it gets very sweaty. Very sweaty.
I find that plausible, though, because I think Josh, because he's already uprooted his life by throwing out his career, is probably being more ready. And he's not engaged. I feel like he's more ready to throw everything up into upheaval than Ruby is, because literally her boyfriend, isn't he arriving the next day?
Or like the weekend, at the weekend.
Yeah, so he's like, he's coming imminently. So there's like a lot to unpack, but I kind of like that idea, because I feel as like they both seem to have somewhat of a moral compass, is because we don't see them kiss. I don't think we really see them touch much other than dancing. I feel like there is like sort of a moral part of them that's holding them apart. But this is the thing. It's like you sit there and you think about it and you're like, which way did it go? And like you said, you just keep rotating it. Did you like the ending? Not like the ending because of that.
I would say I really, really liked the ending, and I like that I can't decide what I think that they did and what choice they made, and I like that a lot. Like I said at the very beginning of the podcast, I think that the ending is what brings this movie from like a charming 80-minute indie movie to something that is like really stuck with me, and I think will be something that I continue to think about and maybe like revisit at different points in my life with different perspective on relationships and have different ideas about what it means. And I think that's very special.
Yeah, it's that open messiness of you don't know for certain what they did. But I feel like in my heart, I feel like in terms of what was intended, it feels like they intend you to think they get together. It's a matter of how they get together and under what circumstances they get together. And I love being able to wrestle with that forever and ever and ever. And it isn't just neatly tied up in a bow like so many movies feel like they have to, because, a committee of producers decided that they needed to. I think it's the strongest choice in the movie is that it leaves it. Well, it leaves it open to where most of the time I feel like they end up getting together in some respect. And then there are parts of the time where I'm like, maybe they don't.
Yeah, I feel like it's not so strongly forcing you into a particular answer to that question, which is why it works for me. And I could see them going like, no, this is not a good way to start a relationship, and walking away. And I could also see them, you know, all of the options in between. So like it says that Emily Ting, the writer director, was inspired by Before Sunrise, which they did do that movie in three parts over a long span of time.
Yeah, they basically, I think it was like a 10-year gap between movies.
Yeah. So it's like, would you want to see Emily Ting do something like that with this and come back with these same actors in another 10 years to find out what happened? Or do you want to leave it just in your mind and you can think about this movie and ponder it occasionally?
If she felt like she had a compelling second installment in the story of these two people, of their lives to tell, totally. But I would be totally fine with it just being left right the way that it is.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, if she felt like she had a really good reason to make a sequel, then I would trust her with it, and I definitely want to see it. But yeah, I don't think it needs one.
I agree. But I would be interesting to sort of revisit in that leisurely way.
Yeah, that's the other element of the ending that I love, is that it has me wrestling with that too. Is, do I want to see a 5 years later version of this where they decided to just part company and that they were about to wreck both of their lives and they have been completely apart for 5 years and they've just happened to run back into each other? And then I go, oh, but do I want to see that movie? Or do I want to see the movie where they've been together for 5 years? And wrestling with that, my instinct is that I enjoy that more than feeling like this has to get followed up.
Yeah, I don't feel like I need it, but I feel like that possibility is out there and I don't mind it sitting out there as something that could happen. The last thing I want to look at is, how is this as a virtual vacation, and does this movie make you want to go to Hong Kong? Do you feel like you've been there?
Oh, it 100% makes me want to go to Hong Kong. Like, the whole time I was like, damn, okay. It was, because it's all shot at night. It's just like, it really features like nightlife of Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't even like going out that much, but I want to go out here. This seems awesome.
Yeah, every movie that I see set and shot in Hong Kong makes me want to visit more. And I've been watching them like my whole life, and having ancestral connections to it, it makes me hungry. It makes me burn with wanderlust. And it always helps to have street food in a movie to make you hungry. And even if you're not necessarily feeling like spicy crab, talking about dim sum just reminds you about dim sum. Mm. And Wednesday is all-you-can-eat dim sum at my favorite dim sum place, but I think it's all to go at the moment. But that's just fine by me, because that stuff travels well.
It does. I have tried getting dim sum delivered during the pandemic, and it was good. I have a loving relationship with dumplings. I did go to China as part of my MA in intercultural communications, and I spent 5 weeks in China, but I was in northern China.
Oh, you're on the mainland, like up Shanghai, Beijing?
Yeah, I was in Beijing, and we did a little bit of traveling around, but in northern China, dim sum is less of a thing. Hot pot is a thing. We had a fantastic hot pot.
Yeah, hot pot is your mainland thing, but the Cantonese, that is our thing, man. Dim sum, all day and all night.
When you talked about the movie earlier, Moises, and talking about how they filmed it, I think because they filmed it, it feels like, you know, they've got sort of head height, shoulder height cameras. It feels unlike any of the other movies we've been watching. Like, we're literally walking through the city constantly, going into the markets and wandering through. It feels like you're very present in a way that hardly any other movies that make me feel that way. So when I was watching the movie, I just love that, sinking into it. Yeah.
I found it hilarious that he brought up guidebooks, and the movie is a bit of a guidebook, like Chungking mansions, you know, it's slums that have loads and loads, like tailor shops and all kinds of stuff crammed into this tiny space that it's, I mean, you know, Chungking Express, it takes place in that area. One on One Car Wise, big movies, the escalators, totally something that's featured in all the tourist guides. The Star Ferry that they re-meet on, I mean, that's a thing. But there are various things that you see that, whether you've watched a bunch of movies set in Hong Kong, or you just, you know things about it, you know, from the tourist guidebook sense of things, you hit a bunch of pieces of that kind of stuff just as they're walking and wandering around. And frankly, the Hong Kong Tourism Board should have sponsored this movie and just paid for the whole budget.
Of all the movies we put on our virtual vacation, it feels the most like I've traveled to the location, instead of like watching and appreciating aspects of the place.
Yeah, I would urge people to, once travel is a thing again, to see Hong Kong now, so that you can see this version of Hong Kong while it lasts, because things are changing rapidly in China. There's a reason that all those protests are happening.
Any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
The one thing I'll tag back on is, earlier I mentioned them getting lost in each other's eyes dancing. Sure, they're a real life couple. It is still rather rare to have that. Okay, now this is the part where you get lost in each other's eyes and you actually see it and feel it happening. And that's one of the most effective bits of body language being spoken in a movie that's full of body language, where you're reading the way that people are, you know, standing and walking next to each other. And that in particular is just one of my favorite snapshots from the movie.
I guess the last thing that I'll say is, I think we've been speaking with much appreciation for lots of elements of this movie and for Emily Tang, who created it. And her next film is called Go Back to China, which I just looked up to see, like, does she have anything coming out? And I realized I know this film because I followed the actress who starred in it. And so that it's a movie that premiered at South by Southwest last year, and I don't know if it's available to watch yet, but definitely will be.
It is
great.
It's good.
Okay,
yes,
great. So can, I'm gonna watch that, and you all should too.
I think at least relatively recently it was on sale in iTunes for ridiculously little money for what a fun movie it is. And Richard Ng, who plays the fortune teller in Already Tomorrow in Hong Kong, is also in this movie too. And he's in loads of Hong Kong movies, like Jackie Chan movies from 30 years ago, loads of stuff. Like you see that fortune teller dude in a bunch of Hong Kong movies.
Cool.
I have to say that she would be someone I would seek out and see more of her films, because there was something about the pacing, the storytelling. It just felt like reading a really good book, or this is something that I'm like, oh, this is a great one to talk about in a podcast because of how it's done. I feel like we could probably talk about it much longer. It just has a lot of meat to it. Yeah, I enjoyed it quite a lot. So yes, we should all go back to China and Hong Kong. But we're going to wrap up this leg of our virtual vacation and pack our bags and get ready to go to the next stop. Oh, I loved him so much. Agents of Smooch is part of the Incomparable Network, where you can find many great pop culture podcasts. If you are enjoying our show and our virtual vacation, please tell your friends or leave us a review on your favorite podcatcher. You can find us on Twitter at Agents of Smooch, and you can become a member of the Incomparable Network at theincomparable.com. Our members get some fun extra perks, including our growing list of incomprehensible Agents of Smooch tipsy commentaries. And until next time, agents, stay safe.